From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, our foreign policy contributor talks about the challenge for the media in covering terrorist acts without spurring others to commit them.
Maintaining professional standards in the face of almost insurmountable drives, and certainly pervasive drives for profits, but maintaining professional journalistic standards, avoiding what we used to call sensationalism, is still in order.
Later, Milwaukee writer Kathleen Davis thinks about her sons going into their next stage of life, and then realizes that means her life is changing too.
And sociologist and former pro football player Robert Turner says high-level college athletes may be getting a free education, but it doesn't mean they're getting the lessons they need to succeed off the field.
Athletes, particularly in the revenue-generating sports, and even more so we shine a light on football, they are discouraged from thinking critically.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Lawmakers in New Zealand are reportedly working to revise that country's gun laws following this month's mass shootings at two mosques that killed at least 50 people and wounded many others. It's a story that has resulted in a worldwide conversation about white nationalism, among other topics.
That story is where we begin our conversation with our regular foreign policy contributor, Art Sear, professor of political economy and world business at Carthage College. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you, Mitch. Always a pleasure to be reinvited, and happy spring.
Happy spring to you as well. It sort of looks and feels like spring outside.
Finally, yes.
Sadly, we are going to start our conversation by turning to a place where it is about to be fall, and that is New Zealand, where the government is exploring potential changes to gun laws there following the mass shooting at two mosques. As we're having this conversation, authorities in the Netherlands are searching for a shooter who killed several people on board a tram in Utrecht. How do you think these tragic shootings are related to what we experience too frequently in this country?
Well, I think it's naturally human to look for connections and see broad trends in individual incidents. These are individual tragic murderous incidents, and there's nothing new about murder. We do have a pervasive instant electronic media. So a person who wants to be, for despicable reasons, an instant celebrity can achieve that by carrying out a murder, ideally multiple murders in terms of celebrity. In the interest of being helpful, Professor Samuel Huntington, who's well known currently mainly for The Clash of Civilizations, his best-selling book about cultural conflict, had other profound ideas and has had a great impact not just among educators and intellectuals but in policy circles in our time. During the 60s, he was a target partly because he was a hardliner on Vietnam at Harvard University, and he developed the notion of a demonstration effect, that it was not pervasive in the same sense that it is today, but we did have international television coverage by the 60s. Which was pretty rapid. And in terms of student demonstrations and other radical demonstrations of that very challenging time, he developed the idea that because of the media, one kind of event can inspire another kind of violent event. And I think that's a profound insight. He's not the first person to come up with that idea, but he popularized it and he defined it very clearly, and it certainly applies today.
It's certainly a complicated question for the media in terms of how you cover something like this without necessarily giving the person that perpetrates it the platform that they're clearly craving.
Yes, I do think that maintaining professional standards in the face of almost insurmountable drives, and certainly pervasive drives for profits, but maintaining professional journalistic standards, avoiding what we used to call sensationalism, is still in order.
It is interesting at the same time to watch how the debate over new gun laws in New Zealand is playing out and compare it to the way that discourse about gun laws in this country plays out in the wake of a shooting like that.
Yeah, it's certainly true. I believe in this country we have such a pervasive black market, and our culture is such that I'm all for stringent gun control legislation and strict gun laws. But I believe there are problems beyond that that contribute to what is still a relatively high level of violence in this country. Although, again, compared to the 60s, violent crime, a pervasive problem back then, that is not a problem today. Violent crime rates are low in this country compared to our history. New Zealand, like colony, now a member of the Commonwealth of Great Britain, in modern times, it's been a pretty nonviolent country, so these incidents are particularly shocking. I do think there's one thing the news media can do is emphasize the more positive aspects of terrible news. And Abdulaziz Wahabzada, the very heroic Islamic gentleman who quite courageously went on the offensive against the killer in New Zealand and managed to scare him off and eventually into police custody, he deserves a great deal of credit and commendation, and I'm glad to see he's starting to receive that.
The New Zealand shooter obviously targeted people of the Muslim faith. And again, as we're having this conversation, there's some possibility that may have been the case in the Netherlands as well. What kind of worldwide leadership might it take to scale back this kind of hostility towards one faith or among faiths or between faiths and the more secular world?
Well, religious leaders traditionally have a role to play. National leaders obviously do as well. And I was glad to see that the president, our president, President Trump, immediately not only condemned the incident, but was in direct communication with the Prime Minister of New Zealand. Surely he helped himself politically and not just in this country. And I think that's a good example in a context like this. The more that we can, through education, combat prejudice of various kinds and extreme nationalism, the better. That sounds like a bromide, but actually it's true and is best implemented on an individual and local basis.
Let us shift to another very messy situation, and that is the ongoing Brexit. I've been searching for the right noun to describe what Brexit is at this point in the UK. A debacle, a quagmire, I don't know. What would you think is the right word to describe Brexit at this point?
A very frustrating situation for the Prime Minister. It is not an international challenge in the way that it tends to be reported and discussed. It's very much within Britain. The European Court of Justice, the Supreme Court, if you will, of the European Union, which dates back to the early 1950s, made it very clear in December that if the British want to remain in the European Union, they can do so. It's not an adversarial situation across national boundaries. It's very much a kind of fascinating and frightening conflict among the British people themselves.
Well, it's interesting.
In that sense, it's self-limiting.
And as you watch it, I mean, if my understanding is correct, the current state of things, as we're having this conversation, and things may change a bit between the time we're able to record this and the time we're able to air it, but Britain is due to leave the EU on March 29th, but there is hope from Prime Minister Theresa May and some others that an extension until June could be put into place. But, of course, there's no assurances that anything would be different by then.
No. But, again, the situation is stable. I'd make two points. Parliament is very much – they've made it clear in their multiple votes that they're very much not only willing but in favor of an extension so that there's not an abrupt departure from the European Union with no deal. The Prime Minister has lost and lost badly on two major votes. She may survive and succeed in her next vote, but given the size of the majority against her, I am willing to predict that her days are numbered as Prime Minister. And her inability to control her party, a basic test, a very tough test of government leadership in Britain. So far, she's failed that test, even though she obviously succeeded in becoming Prime Minister very quickly after David Cameron went down.
Well, and hard to imagine that there might be any Prime Minister in place at this point in time with this issue who would have had an easy time of navigating through it.
No, but you don't have to be so confrontational, says the academic safely sitting on the sidelines. The referendum just barely, 52 to 48, I believe, voted in favor of leaving. A politician in a democracy can, with multiple viewpoints in play, can finesse this kind of situation. She is part of a hardline generation of younger Tories, younger conservative MPs who came in the 1997 general election. Even though Labour won and Tony Blair continued, there was a very, very right-wing group of conservatives, including Prime Minister May at the time, who were elected to office. And they really personify the historic ambiguity that the British people have toward Europe and a kind of basic hostility toward the continent.
Would you say, I mean, the way this is playing out, it seems to have shades of the government shutdown in this country?
Well, that's an interesting comparison, and we should both think and talk more about that. Keep in mind that capital is very fluid. You have more and more initial public offerings in the commercial and business worlds that don't involve an initial investment bank offering on Wall Street. Capital is more and more fluid. We have student groups at Carthage who raise funds through something called GoFundMe, where I gather you ask for money and you get it. I don't believe, even if Britain abruptly left the European Union, there would be dislocations, but I don't believe economic disaster is on the horizon. We really live increasingly in a global trade as well as financial marketplace. Keep in mind always, since the news can be so vexing and disturbing, that the European Union and predecessors was put in place to prevent a third war in Europe, to integrate Germany bluntly, so intimately in the rest of the economic life of wider Europe, that a third war would be less likely, and that's worked. Germany is a very positive and benign leader in Europe and internationally, I believe, and the British continued their good role of setting the right example in terms of human rights and the rule of law. They have a term called muddling through, which is important to keep in mind in trying to understand their sometimes rather strange political conflicts. And it's also worth rereading Alice in Wonderland anytime. Lewis Carroll's classic explains a lot.
Well, and so then I wonder if the comparison to the government shutdown isn't an economic one, but maybe just in terms of how the politics of the situation are playing out.
It's something to think about. I hadn't looked at it quite that way before. Their government is not shutting down. One point that comes to mind, any U.S. president has far more administrative appointments than any British prime minister, not just in the foreign policy field, which is a small field, but throughout these large governments, enormous governments. And in Britain, you have a civil service that's much more continuous and has overall much more power vis-a-vis political appointees than is the case in this country. So in that sense, even if they did shut down, they wouldn't shut down. But their system is such, I don't believe they've ever had the, they have a unified parliamentary system, and you don't have the kind of confrontations that have led, especially starting with the Carter administration, between the Congress and the president that leads to this unfortunate habit of shutting down part of our government. They don't have it, and that's one reason why they find us a little hard to understand.
So let's travel not too far from the UK, just across the English Channel to France. This past weekend was an especially violent one for the Yellow Vest protest, the Gilets Jaunes, in France. It was the 18th weekend of these protests. They had and still have plenty of support, perhaps in principle, around that country. But it's also starting to sound like many other people in France are starting to lose patience with the protests and their risks to life and property. What is the complex route forward in a country with a tradition of popular protest?
A tradition of popular protest and also a highly divided political culture. Stanley Hoffman, Hoffmann, many years ago brilliantly analyzed the French political system from a Euro-American point of view. And anybody who really wants to look in depth, I would commend his works to you, along with Charles de Gaulle's memoirs. De Gaulle put in place, when he came back to power, the great World War II leader of the Free French, he put in place strong executive institutions, a president that remarkably is in some ways even stronger than our president in terms of an ability to control the media, if necessary, by executive authority. And since then, we haven't had the revolving door cabinets and governments that characterized France. They had a 7-year presidential term, which de Gaulle put in place. It's now been shortened to 5. And when the president looks like he or she, conceivably she, might be going down, that's when France is in crisis. So far, these constitutional reforms that de Gaulle put in place have maintained stability and democratic order in a democratic system in a way that was very different earlier in France. So despite the popular protests, I'm optimistic, not necessarily about President Macron's survival. He's become quite unpopular very quickly.
He did not have any kind of...
But about the system.
Civil service.
Excuse me.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, he didn't really have any kind of civil service background, which might make leadership at this kind of time difficult for him, right?
Interesting. Yes. Well, he was, he's still pretty young. He did have a brief but brilliant career, I believe, as a public servant, but he made his name and his money primarily as an investment banker, I think, before he exploded on the political scene. But you're quite right. He's an outsider. But one of the points Hoffman makes is there's no such thing as an insider, given the fractured nature of French political culture, greatly reinforced by their traumatic wartime experience and the undeniable record that a rather large percentage of the population did collaborate with the Nazis.
In a lot of ways, you look at the situation there, and it is somewhat reminiscent of the rural-urban divide that exists in this country.
Yeah, that's another interesting analogy, and you're obviously in good form today, and that's a little easier one for me to get my head around, because we do have a dramatic split in this country, which I believe the 2016 election and our current president personify. And that's much more, to me, comparable to the rural radicalism and the kind of divisions that you associate with France. Yeah, interesting point.
Well, plenty of interesting points that you raised as well. Artsir, always nice to see you, and thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Mitch. It's a pleasure and thought-provoking, too.
Artsir is a professor of political economy and world business, and he directs the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He is a regular contributor to Lake Effect, and you can listen back to his past interviews and commentaries at WUWM.com.
A quick break now, and then a Milwaukee writer revisits the advice she gave other parents who are on the verge of sending a child into the world of adulthood. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Back now with more of Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. A couple of years ago, Milwaukee area realtor and writer Kathleen Davis was on the verge of sending her oldest child off to school. And that got her to wondering whether childhood and adolescence had truly prepared him for the independence that he'd soon have. The result was her book, You Never Told Me That, a crash course in preparing your kids for independence.
Flash forward, and Davis's younger son is now getting ready for college, and the intervening time has had her reflecting on the lessons she put on paper a couple of years ago. Kathleen Davis dropped by the Lake Effect studio recently to pick up where her narrative left off.
Well, when the book ends, my oldest son, Henry, was waiting on college acceptance and just getting ready to head off into the world. And he had kind of jumped off into the world, or I guess jumped off may not be the best word to use, into the world of rock climbing, which was one of the inspirations of the book. And it had left me with a lot of worries about where he was in his decision-making as he was ready to go out into the world.
Right. Was he ready to be there?
Right. Exactly. So, I mean, decision-making is a pretty critical part of rock climbing. And of course, going out into the world and going to college. So I was, you know, it inspired writing a book that hopefully led parents and kids to be thought, you know, provoked in terms of conversations about decision-making.
Well, and so, of course, when the book ends, your life, you know, the circumstances keep going on regardless of where the book ends. And so now we're, what, a couple years on? And
yeah.
Presumably your son has still survived his rock climbing exploits. But he's in college and you have another son that's getting ready for it, right?
Yeah, we're kind of fast forward about 2 years, not quite. And my oldest son is in his sophomore year in college. My youngest son is exactly where my oldest son was 2 years ago, waiting on his college acceptance letters and – or no letters, I guess that's –
yeah.
That is dating me. His college acceptance emails.
Yeah.
And Henry has done unbelievably well. He has shown himself to be a great decision maker. But interestingly enough, I had a conversation with him recently that, you know, brought it all full circle again, where he questioned his, you know, what has the past couple years in college meant? And has it all been a waste? Or you know, and that really jumped out to me as an unbelievable question. That coupled with questions from other parents really was really thought inspiring to me, because a lot of parents who are in the same predicament that I'm in, I'm just ready to, you know, I'm almost going to be an empty nester, which is really, you know, unbelievable to me. And
unbelievable, scary, I would imagine. Or
just, I mean, kind of just interesting. It is scary, I think, but it's also exciting. And I think it's just I don't know who could possibly get to this point and not start wondering, like, what am I going to do? Am I going to do the same thing I've been doing for the last 20 years while I'm raising my children? Am I going to take on new adventures? Who am I? What am I going to do? And I think what's happening to Henry as he's at school is, what am I going to do in 2 years or in 4 years or whenever I'm done with school? And is what I'm doing now preparing me to get there? And I think parents are like, oh my gosh, I've defined myself by these children for so long. Is that who I am?
So really what's going on here is that there's this great parallel. You have a son who's asking himself many of the same questions that you're asking. At the same time, you have, you know, a lot more life experience behind you to be asking and evaluating the answers to those questions. How do you counsel your son when he's wondering, you know, after 2 years, whether he's wasting his college experience?
Well,
what'd you tell him?
After I catch my breath, because of course it's upsetting for any parent to believe that their child is wasting their college experience. The dollar signs are floating over your head.
Oh yeah.
But then, you know, you have to counsel yourself at the same time you're counseling your child. Because I guess, you know, after I had a moment to think about it, I really think strongly, you can't define who you are by one thing that you're doing in college or one, you know, your major is not you. People could say, what do you do? I am a realtor at Sotheby's International. That is one part of me. I am a mother. That is one part of me. Each thing I do is part of me. Each thing that Henry does is part of him. It is not who he is, and he needs to learn that. You have to be able to define yourself by, you know, deeper things about who you are, and not this one thing that you're doing. And then if one of those things goes away, you're still you.
Do you think that's something that maybe gets kind of not discussed enough in college, the idea that, you know, because, I mean, it's been a while since I've been in college, but I remember thinking, okay, so I'm a politics major. You know, you see the same people a lot. You see, you're doing a lot of the same things, and, you know, it's easy to forget that you're these other people as well.
Well, okay, so good point. And I guess what I would encourage is, I do think that's, you know, it's kind of like getting in a rut. I mean, we all do it. You get up every morning, you go do what you have to do in order to pay your mortgage and to, you know, live your life. We all have to do it. And I do the same thing. And then every once in a while, you close your eyes and daydream, or, you know, you get a dalliance of vacation or whatever it is. And you think, gosh, I wish I were, you know, my little fantasy about living in a van and selling artwork and writing books all the time and, you know, whatever it is. And those are, we think they're all fantasies. But for some of us, maybe they're more than that at some point in our lives. And, you know, I really believe it's a choice. And
the dream is part of you, right?
It's part of you. Yeah, and maybe it's more than part of you. And I think that a lot of us spend a lot of time thinking, you know, what if, or, oh, that's only for later, or, you know, you have to really, you know, acknowledge those things about yourself. Again, I'm going to sound a little bit cliche. There's no later. You know, you, of course, you have to do what you have to do. But if you find yourself saying, I wish, I wish, I wish, too many times, you might want to consider what that means and make that thing you're thinking about a bigger part of your life.
So how do these lessons that you're figuring out, you know, the ones you figured out or thought you figured out as your first son went off to college, how are they applying to your second son, who is, you know, waiting for those emails letting him know where he might go?
Well, they're pretty different kids. My second son is is rather strong-willed. So he has often really followed his heart and done many of the things that he really loves that are not always conventional. He's very academically bright and works extremely hard. But he's also followed some unusual passions. He's a very talented musician, and he has dipped into the world of modeling. So he's run off to New York for 3 weeks in the middle of school while still handling all his complete course load in school. And, you know, that was certainly unconventional and did not exactly sit well with the school. But he did it because it was something he felt passionate about.
Well, and it sounds like, you know, to go back to what you were talking about before, he understands that these are all parts of him.
They're parts of him, right. And, you know, part of me worries about him and thinks, like, gosh, wonder what he's going to do with his life. But the other part of me thinks, you know, I got to trust him. He is smart. He's going to figure it out. I know that I can't control his mind any more than he can control mine.
Well, so. And it sounds like he is not one to say I wish because he's already doing these things.
He's definitely a doer, and I really respect that about him. You know, if I would have any regret in my life, it would be not doing something that I wish that I could. And, you know, I mentioned to you as I was walking into this interview today that after I wrote this book, many people came up to me and said, I wish I could write a book. And I said it was really a, you know, something that I did not enjoy hearing. I'm going to say it that way. Because, you know, I would say to anyone who said that to me, you absolutely can write a book. Why aren't you writing a book then? So I'm not in love with the expression, I wish. Because I believe that if you wish something, that means that you just aren't doing it. It's not that I've never said it, but when I catch myself saying it, I remind myself that I clearly don't want it enough, because if I actually wanted that, I would take the steps to do it.
Well, so you're thinking about your life as an empty nester, which I gather this fall, is that?
And maybe even sooner. George is, his modeling may take him out of the country for the summer, or I may be an empty nester before you know it.
Well, so when you think about these dreams or possibilities out there, how are you thinking you're going to make a decision on, you know, what's next for you? Is there another book that you have to write first?
Well, it's possible that another book is in the works. But, I mean, I'm very focused on taking care of my family and, you know, as I mentioned, the necessity of earning a living. And I work very hard in my real estate career. And, I can't exactly say what yet, but there's some exciting developments coming down the pipeline for me with Mahler Sotheby's. So we've got some big things in the works. And I love my real estate career. I've been doing it for 23 years. And, you know, I love going into work every day. But with that being said, I would, you know, be lying if I didn't say that I have some thoughts in my head about the future and, you know, someday maybe living somewhere warm. And, you know, I'm passionate about painting, about art, and about writing. And yes, I have plans someday to do those things in a bigger way. And I think that I will have to take a bit of my own advice and you know, figure out how that fits into my life. I also enjoy public speaking, clearly. You know, it's hard to shut me up. And, you know, I'm very involved with Toastmasters and I enjoy coaching. And so I don't know where it will take me, but I do know this. I will try to heed my own advice, and I will take every opportunity that I can to step outside of my box.
Well, Kathleen Davis, maybe we have figured out how to shut you up, because I think we've gotten to the end of the interview. Thank you so much. Well, and best of luck with where the road takes you from here, and maybe another couple of years down the road we'll want another update.
Well, thank you very much.
Kathleen Davis is a Milwaukee area realtor and writer. Her book, You Never Told Me That, A Crash Course in Preparing Your Kids for Independence, came out a couple of years ago, and you can find a link to the interview we did then at WUWM.com.
Going to college or becoming an empty nester can be a difficult transition, but as we'll hear next, so can going from being a pro athlete to being an ex-pro athlete. Stay tuned. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. As we heard in our last segment, life transitions can be tough, whether it's from adolescence to adulthood or from one period of adult life to the next.
Transitions can also be difficult for people who seem to have everything at their fingertips, such as professional athletes. For many, by the time they retire or are forced from the game by injury or obsolescence, they've been in their sport for 20 or 30 years, and they often find it difficult, financially, emotionally, or both, to adjust to life after sports.
Robert Turner has devoted his life since leaving pro football to figuring out why that's the case. Turner earned a PhD in sociology and now teaches in the School of Medicine and Health Sciences at George Washington University. He is the author of a new book called Not for Long, The Life and Career of the NFL Athlete, based on research he did for his dissertation. He joined us in the studio recently. Welcome back to the show.
It's great, actually. This is the first time that I've ever returned back to a place that I did an interview before. So this is a great experience for me, especially since you saw the early version from a dissertation.
We are honored. So this is kind of a strange place to start, but it kind of sets everything in motion. Tell me about the day you were cut from the San Francisco 49ers.
Yeah, that's definitely. So that day was, you know, and a lot of different reasons, that was the biggest day of my life. Essentially, that was the day that I was confronted with the reality that my football career was over. You know, after 16 years of playing, from the time I was in, you know, Pop Warner football to high school to college, and then I played 4 years professionally on different teams across three different leagues. And when I sat there, you know, it's funny, it was a very strange thing. The night before, I actually was thinking to myself, yeah, I had a great practice, and I said, you know, but I was also playing for the 49ers, you know, they were Super Bowl champs at the time. And I said, if when it's time for me to go, I'll be satisfied knowing that I have played the best that I can. I gave it all on the field. I didn't know that the next morning they called me into the office and said, okay, thank you, but no thank you. And then, you know, he asked me that question, where do you want to go? And at that moment, everything just, my heart sank. I started getting cold sweats. I couldn't hear because I realized what he was saying and how I knew what it meant is that my career was done. What do you want to do next in your life? And I had no answer to that question, and I wasn't prepared to answer it. And so, you know, for that moment, I didn't know where I wanted to go. So I asked him if I could take the night, think about it, and then get back to him at that point. And that was really the start of a very long journey to try to figure out what football had meant to me and how do I kind of disconnect my identity from this football identity.
Right. He was asking, you know, what airport do you want to fly
exactly.
to? And at the same time, when you hear the question, it dawns on you, you've got to figure out really just what's next in a bigger sense.
Absolutely. And the thing about it, for this book at least, when I did the research initially in graduate school as part of my dissertation, I didn't write about myself in the book about that at all. But my mentor and really dear friend, one of my mentors, Dr. Carol Stack, who's an emeritus from Duke and UC Berkeley, she said, if you're going to write this book, there's three things you have to do. One, you have to write about yourself. The second thing you have to do is you have to write about race. And the third thing, if you need to write about gender, right, masculinity. And I didn't want to touch any of those. So she made me put this whole story about myself squarely in the middle of it. And that really is what this whole book is about.
Well, and so we spoke, and I think it was we figured out 9 years ago while this was in the process of coming together as your dissertation, you were at Marquette University doing a lot of the groundwork for what became this book. Once you got to the point where it went from dissertation to what's in front of us today, was there a single overarching question you were trying to answer or issue you wanted to illuminate above everything else?
Yes. I didn't realize it at the time when I did all of the dissertation work, when I did all the field work, when I wrote up all the notes, and even when I wrote the first, you know, what I submitted as my dissertation work, I didn't realize that the book was really about why do athletes struggle with their transition to life after football? But conversely, it also meant that how did some people make successful transitions to life after football? And so the book gives you a couple of examples. And I think that all of us are at points in our lives where we hit those crises and we ask ourselves, what do we do now? What happens when the roof crumbles in and we weren't prepared for it? But we have to keep on keeping on. And that's really, I think, what these athletes can give us a sense of. What happens when you plan your whole life to be successful and you actually finally do get that brass ring, but then that ring slips through your fingers? What do you do next?
Well, and so let's talk about some of the things that set the foundation for all of that, starting with youth sports. And I'm not sure exactly how old you are, but I imagine we are fairly close to being contemporaries here. Youth sports, when we were kids, did not seem to be a part of the sports industrial complex as they are today. What happened to youth sports?
Well, I think, and that's a good point. I really do emphasize that, the whole sports industrialization complex that we talk about. What we have today is the professionalization of youth sports. You know, I was flabbergasted, 20, 30 years ago when Tommy John had his surgery, maybe longer than that for those who are, historians would know. That was revolutionary surgery at the time that helped his career. I've been told lately that actually some families have used a Tommy John surgery as elective surgery for their kids today to prolong their careers over time in baseball. And so we have pressures today on young people that we've never seen before. I guess the most real example is lately is where we see that the University of Michigan, Jim Harbaugh, just offered a seventh grader a scholarship to play quarterback at the University of Michigan. I don't make that mistake. And so kids have a lot of pressure. Think about being the kid who received that scholarship offer, what he has to live up to. But even more importantly, think about the tens of thousands of kids who read that, hear it, and then they wonder, what about me? What does it say about me at this age and the pressure that they put themselves under?
Well, and youth sports is also a time at which race and socioeconomic factors really come into the kinds of opportunities that kids have as well.
Well, absolutely. I was just writing an op-ed piece about this very thing. You know, there was a piece in The Atlantic. I don't know if you read about it. They quoted me in there, and they wanted to understand are we having this kind of break where more African-American kids or kids from lower socioeconomic background will wind up playing football because wealthier kids and white kids, their families will be removing them from football because of, the head concussions, which I think is a little curious because the one thing that we also see at the same exact time is over the last 20 years, hockey has been growing in sports, and they're not growing with black kids. They're growing with a lot of white kids. So I think it's more than the fears about concussions, but we definitely see today with the youth sports and the professionalization, their families are paying upwards of $6,000, $7,000, $10,000 for private lessons, coaching, facilities, all of these different things. It's really a story about the have and the have not so often.
Well, and you write about, I think, a former player who wanted to start a number of football camps and really try to offer some of the same kinds of opportunities for players of color, but was confronted with the reality that, these are families that and high school teams that really can't afford to pay much in order to be able to tap into like former NFL talents.
Well, that was really one of, the most striking experiences for me in writing the book with Odessa Turner, who's the athlete you're talking about. And we went out to Connecticut, and we wanted to work with a couple of teams, their inner city team and as well as a rural team. And both of them said, we don't have the money, but what we have is a lot of enthusiasm and our kids really need you to come out there. So Odessa realized he couldn't work for free, but he really cut it down significantly on what the costs were. And that showed us that there were a lot of kids there. Ironically, the white kid that was on the all-black team, he was the one that said, I'm playing football because I need a scholarship and there's no other way that I can get to college but through this. But we also see, and I write about this in the book as well, is there's Test Sports, which was in New Jersey, Martinsville, New Jersey, which is a well-economic, very wealthy place. Their parents were paying all kinds of money for them to get personalized lessons from former NFL athletes. And so we see how race and class are all over sports in America today.
Well, and so then let's talk about football at the high school and college level. And one of the revelations that came to me is that, for a sport that requires its players to have a really smart grasp of some very complex offensive and defensive plays and really be able to think while they're on the field and act while they're on the field, players are not really encouraged to think or do for themselves off the field.
Well, that I agree with. I write about that very much in the book. I think that there are plenty of people in the NCAA who would want to argue vehemently against that. There are people at where I wrote, you know, a lot of the book and did a lot of discussions and data collection at UNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, that would tell you otherwise. But I think it bears out to be true. The one thing that we know, as far as I'm concerned, that I will argue, is that athletes, particularly in the revenue-generating sports, and even more so we shine a light on football, they are discouraged from thinking critically. It's not that they're discouraged from thinking, but I guess the people running the show don't want the athletes thinking critically and asking questions about who controls and benefits from this institution.
We hear about academic scandals in big-time college sports, and you know, you spoke at length to the whistleblower at UNC.
Mary Whittingham, yes. Exactly.
Right, who exposed the really shady practices that were
Absolutely.
Going on there. What is the cost to the students, you know, who are at least theoretically student-athletes? We hear a lot about, and we think, you know, this is crazy that these classes don't really exist or that there are people who are essentially doing work for them. But, you know, when we think about these players' lives after they leave UNC or wherever they've gone to college,
all
what's the cost
country.
To them? Yeah.
Well, I think the cost starts very, very early, not just in gearing people towards classes where other people might be doing their work, bogus classes altogether, or classes that aren't really challenging them enough. And this is really what I try to do is build on the work of Dr. Harry Edwards, who is, you know, a famous sociologist, and he's credited with being the father of the sociology of sports in America. And people may know him from the famous boycott back in the Olympics in 1968. And he tried to shed light on some of the injustices in sports back then. And I try to really pick up on the work that he has done. But he argues, and I think it might be still relevant today, it's worth asking the question and really examining, but he says particularly if you look at football where 70%, almost 70% of the athletes in the NFL are African-American, black, in NCAA, the numbers are almost as significant, particularly when you're looking at the people who are starters and playing on the field. And so he says it is a drain of resources from those communities where some of your talented, best and brightest are solely focused on making it in sports and using sports as a meritocracy instead of looking at ways of which they could become doctors, lawyers, dentists, and other significant contributors to the community. So he's not saying that sports is bad, and I'm not at all. I think it's beneficial. I'm a person that's benefited greatly from it. But it's that kind of, I guess, blind commitment and neglect of other areas to pursue of excellence, and that we'd like to see lots of young men and young women who turn to sports as that means for upward mobility.
Well, and so you're right that by the time most players, if they are good enough, make it to the NFL, you know, sort of years of social conditioning have put them in this position where they're really only prepared for life on the field. But that's most. You did, as you said at the beginning of this interview, speak with some players and former players who, against the odds, it seems, were actually better prepared than others. Players like, I think it was a former Packers wide receiver, Derek Mays. What puts some of these players in this position where they are actually able to succeed once their playing career is over?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Derek. He's a great friend. I got to know Derek actually well before I came to Milwaukee at Marquette. And I didn't realize how this would all kind of come together. But Derek, I write about him in the book primarily. He's a great example. Derek's mom was a high school teacher. She had taught several football players before her, so she understood how, and this is what I really argue this point in the book, is that people say, well, is the NCAA the, you know, the bad, you know, the Gestapo, so to speak, and I have my opinions about that. But what I will say is that in college sports, particularly revenue-generating sports, they will exploit vulnerable athletes. If you, particularly a first-generation athlete, you're looking in sports for to be your ticket out, you may very well get taken advantage of. The nice thing about Derek's story is that his mom, being a teacher, she understood that his education was primary and made it a very large focus in the household. Derek also comes from a household where his father was an entrepreneur, a small business owner. Derek was taught very early in his life that you will never get truly ahead as long as you are working for a paycheck. You need to be able to build your own thing. So his family, he famously told me that his mom said, "You're going to Notre Dame." No matter where else you might think you might want to go, but the Notre Dame degree, the Notre Dame network, and if you're lucky enough to play in the NFL, all of those things together will give you advantages in life that you will never be able to get anyplace else. And that's exactly how Derek lives his life today. And the other thing I would say real quickly on that, what makes his success, I think, so good is that he played for Coach Lou Holtz, and he shared with me, he said what Lou Holtz would tell the team all the time, all the resources that you need to be successful in life are within your arm's length. All you have to do is go out and grab them or ask for them, and you can be successful on your own terms. And so I think that Derek, you know, that maybe oversimplifies, but he's an example of someone who actually did transition out very well.
What were the things that made the difference for you? You went to James Madison, which at the time was a 1AA school and is now the FCS school.
Yeah, yes, we're still 1AA FCS, yeah. But yes, exactly. Yeah. But they're a powerhouse on that level, yes.
Yeah, but you were able to obviously recognize the importance of education all the while you were coming into your own.
I would say, you know, I wish it were so easy. I would say that things happened for me that was, I just felt so blessed. I mean, I really feel that my faith is very important. God blessed me in ways that I had no idea. But Coach Challis Joe McMillan, when he recruited us way back in the day, and on that team, we had over seven guys that played in the NFL, one of which probably people know the most is Charles Haley, who's in the Hall of Fame, but Gary Clark, Scott Knottwood, all of us. And the coach, when he came into our house, he looked at each one of us and said to our parents and to us personally, you will graduate from James Madison. And when I had some rough times, he called me in the office and said, do you remember I promised your parents that you would graduate? Now, the great thing about him is that he meant not just graduate with a degree, but he meant you will receive a good college education when you come here. And that was, I guess, the foundation of a lot of things so that I could kind of fall back on over the years when I was lost, and I write about it in a book, and I didn't know what I was going to do. Very fortunate that I come from a very strong family that were behind me 100%. But, you know, where Coach told us that education was really important, I think those are the things that years later after I finished playing football that led me to go back and to get a PhD.
For the 4 years you played professionally and the years it took to write the dissertation and then take the dissertation and make it into a book, are you conflicted at all when you watch football today?
No, not at all. Because I think that there's a lot of reasons that people play football. And I've had the great fortune in this book. It was a 4-year ethnography, so I lived with football players. I lived with their families. I've watched them make decisions on where to live, how to raise their kids. I've seen a lot. I've interviewed 140 people. I know what this game means. I spent a lot of time with former players. I know what this game means to people. I know, and football players know what the risks are involved with it, and they're learning more about the risks more than we've ever known. And many people tell you that, you know, this game transformed their lives in a lot of different ways. What I care about the most is what happens to athletes once they leave the game. What do we need to do to help them become better prepared? What do we need to do to take care of their health if they have health problems after the game? What do we need to do to equip them to be prepared as they go through the sports tournament at the early end so that way they can come out of it with the resources that they need to be successful? So really, I'm all about making the game better, making it safer, and empowering the players that and their families that have gone through this thing.
Think all the football players that, who are leaving the game should get a copy of your book?
I think so. I think that, well, I'll put it this way. My mom, after reading the book, she said two things to me that was really great. She said, one, I learned so much more about you, and it answers some questions that I had all these years. But then she also said, after having been a mom that put two kids through major college football, and now she has a grandson playing major college football, she said, I think that every kid and every family that has anybody that plays football and by the extension, any sport that goes to college, they need to read your book. And that was a great endorsement from my mom. So
should have had her blurb it on the back.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Robert Turner, it really is a great read. And congratulations on the book and best of luck from here on out.
I appreciate it very much. And thanks again for having me.
Robert Turner is a professor in the School of Medicine and Health Sciences at George Washington University and the author of Not For Long, The Life and Career of the NFL Athlete. Turner played professional football in the now-defunct USFL, in the Canadian Football League, and briefly for the San Francisco 49ers.
The book is based on some of the work he did for his doctoral dissertation, which included a stint at Marquette University. We spoke with him 9 years ago as that work was coming together, and also last month when he was here to speak at Boswell Book Company.
We will take one last break and then listen back to a music recording from the Lake Effect Performance Studio. Keep listening. We continue in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. It's Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We wrap up our show today with a little music recorded last fall in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. Lil Rev is a familiar name around the country to aficionados of the ukulele. He is the musician behind a number of uke songbooks and albums and the founder of Ukulele Festival that brings fans and players alike to Wisconsin.
Lil Rev lives in Sheboygan now, but one of the songs he played for us is called The Milwaukee Waltz.
Waltz across Texas, misery too, out of the Midwest into the blue. If I could waltz my whole life through, waltz in Milwaukee with you. Baby, won't you shake my blues away? Honey, we could polka most any place. And if I'm gonna love you your dying day, let's waltz in Milwaukee, steal the night away. Tennessee was fine whole night through. Waltz cross Ohio neath a big harvest moon. Nothing that makes me feel so blue, it's when I'm not waltzing with you. Baby, won't you shake my blues away? Honey, we could polka most any place. And if I'm gonna love you your dying day, let's waltz in Milwaukee and steal the night away. Oh, come on now, let's steal it, Little Rev.
Little Rev with his original tune, The Milwaukee Waltz, recorded last fall in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. And that's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air is next.
Baby, won't you shake my blues away? Honey, we could polka most any play. If I'm gonna love you to your dying day, let's waltz in Milwaukee and steal the night away.